One thing one learns is to believe nothing. The only thing I believe is the Bible. And I've learned to believe the spirit of prophecy. But after that, everything you hear, you must check. Even if your loving grandmother tells you, you've got to check. Years ago, I read a book by B.G. Wilkinson called Truth Triumphant. Many moons ago, I got to know a bit about him, his children afterwards. But in this book, he traced the observance of the Sabbath in several parts of the world. And one of the parts of the world was Britain. So in 1943, I was asked to go and be pastor of the church in Edinburgh in Scotland and to hold an evangelistic campaign in that very beautiful ancient city. We rented the Usher Hall, which is another nice building, huge building in the middle of town, and we moved from there to the Masonic Hall. Eventually, to the church that we bought, a congregational church, in Bristow Place, just near the University of Edinburgh. The National Library of Scotland was available to me. It used to be called the Advocates Library then. And so I loved libraries, and I spent all the time I could in that library reading. B.G. Wilkinson had mentioned Skene and Burton and a few other authors who had written about the early observance of the Sabbath in Scotland. So I looked up their books, and when I gave out my sermons and literature that was mimeographed, I put the name and title and author and the call number of the book, so if they want to check it up, go there and ask the young lady, fill in a slip, borrow it, see the evidence. I came to the United States in 1946, the end of August, and walked into what was then the seminary and met an old school chum of mine coming out full of happiness. He had just got his M.A. And we discussed his thesis. In his thesis, he had established that Ellen White had made a mistake. Well, that was kind of arresting. Great Controversy, page 62. In Great Britain, primitive Christianity had very early taken root. The gospel received by the Britons in the first century was then uncorrupted by Romish apostasy. Persecution from pagan emperors, which extended even to these far-off shores, was the only gift that the first churches of Britain received from Rome. Many of the Christians fleeing from persecution in England found refuge in Scotland. Thence the truth was carried to Ireland, and in all these countries it was received with gladness. When the Saxons invaded Britain, heathenism gained control. The conquerors disdained to be instructed by their slaves, and the Christians were forced to retreat to the mountains and the wild moors. Yet the light hidden for a time continued to burn. In Scotland, a century later, it shone out with a brightness that extended to far distant lands. From Ireland came the pious Columba and his co-laborers, who, gathering about them the scattered believers on the lonely island of Iona, made this the center of their missionary labors. Among these evangelists was an observer of the Bible Sabbath, and thus the truth was introduced among the people. A school was established at Iona from which missionaries went out not only to Scotland and England, but to Germany, Switzerland, and even Italy. But Rome had fixed her eyes on Britain and resolved to bring it under her supremacy. In the 6th century, her missionaries undertook the conversion of the heathen Saxons. They were received with favor by the pious barbarians, and they induced many thousands to profess the Romish faith. As the work progressed, the papal leaders and their converts encountered the primitive Christians. Striking contrast was presented. The latter was simple, humble, scriptural in character, doctrine and manners, while the former manifested the superstition, pomp, and arrogance of popery. The emissary of Rome demanded that these Christian churches acknowledge the supremacy of the sovereign pontiff. Britons meekly replied that they desired to love all men, but that the Pope was not entitled to supremacy in the church, and they could render to him only the submission which was due to every follower of Christ. Repeated attempts were made to secure their allegiance to Rome, but these humble Christians, amazed at the pride displayed by her emissaries, steadfastly replied that they knew no other master than Christ. Now the true spirit of the papacy was revealed. Said the Romish leader, "If you will not receive brethren who bring you peace, you shall receive the enemies who will bring you war. If you will not unite with us in showing the Saxons the way of life, you shall receive from them the stroke of death." These were no idle threats. War, intrigue, deception were employed against these witnesses for a Bible faith until the churches of Britain were destroyed or forced to submit to the authority of the Pope. Let me tell you, that is the most succinct, accurate appraisal of 400 years of history that I've ever read in my life. I spent years researching that area. I've read that thing 100 times. When I finished and took every sentence in that, I wouldn't alter a word. Knowing all the pitfalls in history, knowing all the areas of problem, and I thought to myself, there is a third-grade dropout who wrote that. Or did she? Well, now, this little discussion, they didn't keep the Sabbath. Now, he had his M.A. and I didn't have my M.A., so I didn't argue with him. I don't like to argue with people anyway. Tell them what you think. They're of age. If they don't like it, love them. Leave them. So I thought about that. That was 46. I wondered what all those statements were that Skeen had made and Burton had made and all the rest of them had made regarding the observance of the Sabbath, but I was in no position to debate it. And then time passed by and it became necessary for me to get some sort of a degree to decorate a college calendar, so I had to work toward a degree, and I thought it would be fun to work in Johns Hopkins, and so on. Dr. Albright gave me a scholarship there, which was nice because it didn't cost anyone anything. And so I studied there for 2 years. It was called Johns Hopkins, the Oriental Seminary, they called it then. We studied mainly Semitic languages and history, many languages, all of which were allied to Hebrew. Well, after 2 years of that, I could take it no longer. It disgusted me. So I'm a university dropout. I remember coming down old Baltimore from Washington, no freeways in those days, stopping not far from where the Spencerville Church now is, and pulling off in my little old Ford car and having a chat with the Lord. I couldn't take it. It was brainwashing. Nothing in the Bible meant what it said. You showed your smarts by improving it, known as emendations. Oh, if you get the Ethiopic from this, you can get this. And if you get the Ugaritic from that, you can get that. If you get the Syriac from that, you can get that. And if you get the Arabic from that, you can get that. Nothing was what it said. And I had enough. So I quit. I said to the Lord, if you want me to study and get a degree anywhere, you arrange it. Well, arrangements were made, and I had the opportunity to teach at Newbold, and so my brother had gone there to med school in 1920, much older than I, and so I thought I'd go to King's College and get into the University of London and see if I could work on a doctor's program, which I did, and then I decided I was going to write on these two pages of great controversy. And the title that I finally came up was The Beliefs and Practices of the Celtic Church in Britain, every word of which I labored through to get that title. See, it's Big Britain, Great Britain, Little Britain, Brittany, across in France. So you got to define what Britain is. It includes the Isles and, of course, takes in Scotland and Wales and Ireland. See, to a Scotsman, England is a peninsula jutting south from Scotland. And so there's Scotland and Wales and Ireland and England, which are all United Kingdom. Pretty united, like the United States. Some Irishmen are not quite as united as they might be. But this business has been going on. The first fight between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland took place in 629 A.D. I can footnote that from the Annals of Ireland. So my studies took in the beliefs and practices of the Celtic Church. Now there are some ignorant people in Boston who call their ball team Celtic. But the original people spelt their name with a K. So it's not the Celtic Church in Britain. It's the Celtic Church in Britain, although the team is Celtics, whatever you want to call them. The Celts were the original inhabitants. Very little is known about the Celts. And I soon discovered, as I had surmised before, that history is a myth we choose to believe. Now, if Molly was sitting here, she'd say, be careful, Les, don't get too cynical. Don't get too cynical. But you don't believe anything you read until you got the right footnote under it. Then you check the footnote. And you make sure that the fellow that quotes the footnote quotes it correctly. So I wanted to get a picture of the early Christians. Now she says Christianity got a foothold in England early. Nobody knows when or how. Archaeology has found traces. Not far from Newbold is the foundation of a church. 213 or so, they guess. They've covered it up now because it was disintegrating, the stonework and all. It had to be kept. So they've got surveyed it and everything, and you can see from the top they got a model, but they wanted to preserve it, and so it's covered with a couple of feet of sod. It's down there. Remnants of a church in southern Scotland, very early, who knows how early. The first real bits of Christianity that you get is the writing of a man called Patrick. Patrick was a Scotsman. He was born about 30 miles south of the city of Glasgow. He wrote a little book called Confessions and another smaller one called The Letter to Caroticus. Very early. He tells us his father was an elder and his grandfather was a deacon in the church. So there was a church there. There was a little group of Christians. When he was in his late teens, he was captured by some Irish pirates. They needed forced labor and they took him over to Ireland, and there he probably helped in a farm that bred Irish hounds that were very popular in Europe. And on one time he was sent with a cargo of these hounds in a boat that landed in Brittany and then were going overland. There he escaped from the people that he was working for and wound his way back across the English Channel up into Ireland. Somehow, at that time, he became impressed that he ought to work for Christ. And in his little book, he says he had a dream. He could see the youth of Irish saying, come over and help us. And he decided to go over and help the Irish. He found, as he says, his little book. You know, you can get it. It's in English. It was written in Latin, but it's in English. Little book, maybe 25, 30 pages long, full of the Bible. Full of the Bible. Many, many quotes. He believes in the second coming of Christ with all the text he quotes. And he quotes an old Bible, an Itala. An Itala Bible preceded Jerome's Vulgate. So it means that the Christians who came there to Scotland came before Jerome translated his Bible. So they were there before 300. and they brought that Bible, which is sometimes called the African Bible, came over North Africa, probably over Gibraltar, through Spain, up through France and Brittany, and then across the English Channel. There was some way they came in. And he begins to work for them. And they begin to accept Christ. Now this is about 375 A.D. This is about the time it happens, give or take a decade or so. Now what did he believe? Well, his biographers later, and Patrick has got many biographers, 200 years apart, and those biographies differ very greatly. Now, as Ellen White said, she didn't give the date, 6th century, 596 A.D., Augustine, sent from Rome, landed on the island of Thanet in Britain. Now, Patrick was, say, 375 to 400. This was nearly 200 years later. Now, in between, she says, the Saxons came. Now, the Picts from the north began to fight. The English and the Welsh and all the rest of it, they're fighters, always been fighters. And so some of the English sent over to Germany to invite the Saxons to come to help them fight the Picts. And so the Saxons came and pushed the Picts north and then took over England, just as she says. The heathen then overran. Now this come, they came about 450. So you're in 400, 450, 600, 596, the Catholics come. When the Catholics come, as she says here, and you get Bede and everyone, many people, establishing the fact that they found a group of Christians. Now, these are the simple facts. Now, I don't know what you've got in your mind, but how many people are we dealing with? How many people were there in England? How many people were there in Ireland? How many people were there in Scotland? I spent weeks and weeks trying to do a demographic study of the population of Britain in those days. And you can't do it, but you can extrapolate. Say in 1066, remember the Frenchman William conquered Harold, shot him at Hastings, took over Britain, conquered Britain, 1066. And then he wrote a book called Doomsday Book. Sounds terrible, Doomsday. But doom and the 11th century, means a sort of destiny. And so it describes life. And he found a population in the whole of Britain, as far as he could find, of just over a million. So how many people were in Ireland? And then you go back 500 years before, and you say, how many people were in Ireland? So my guess, which all historians have to do, they don't always are honest enough to call them a guess, but the conclusion based on the evidence. Doesn't that sound much more learned? My guess is that there might have been 60,000, 70,000 people in Ireland. I think that's a big number. And about the same number in Scotland. So you're not dealing with millions of people. So when you get historians saying that the Celtic missionaries swarmed over Europe, you have to say, come on, what sort of language you used? Swarm indicates how many? 20? I think if they were 20, they were a lot. Maybe 30. But they make a tremendous impression. So he established Christianity in Ireland. There he taught them the gospel. One of his earliest biographers said, wherever Patrick went, he left a book of the law and a book of the gospel. That's a peculiar statement in Latin. A book of the law and a book of the gospel. They're there. Now what are these? A part of the fun I had doing this study was to try to establish a point that the book of the law was still extant. In fact, there are four copies. Four copies. And the book of the law is called in Latin, Liber ex lege Moisi. Liber is book, ex is out of, lege is the law, and Moisi is Moses. So the title that the manuscript has is The Book Extracted from the Law of Moses. Starts with the Ten Commandments. Nobody's ever published it. So I had fun trying to do that, appendix of my book, making an analysis of this book, of this Liber ex lege. It's not very big. It's a long manuscript made of some kind of animal hide. part of the manuscript's got a hole in it that you can stick your finger right into it. And I thought, that's where the arrow got this poor little animal. But it's there, and they write right up to it and write by the side of it. It's all written by hand. And so I got a photocopy of the thing and analyzed it. Takes all the references to the Sabbath in the Pentateuch. Then it's got a section on clean and unclean meats. Then it's got a section on cities of refuge. Then it's got another section all on the sex laws that he carries out. Little sections. It's a book excerpted from the law of Moses. And I thought, this is interesting. This is what Patrick took. Wherever he went, he left it. There are four of them alive still. One is in the Louvre. The one I looked at was in Cambridge. And there are a couple in the British Museum. British Museum is very difficult to take care of because you've got to park about 60 miles away. And so to get to it is a pain and a pain. So it's much easier to drive 120 miles to Cambridge where you can park anywhere you want and go in there and get it and look at it and go back. So they're there. They're all the same. This means that Patrick was Bible-based. And he also gave a book of the law, a book of the Gospels. And I think there is one copy of that still extant. I didn't push that in my dissertation, but I think it's still there. It is the old Gospels upon which the kings and queens of Britain have taken their oath of office for millennia, 1,400 years. It's a tiny little handwritten Gospel, book of the Gospels. Most valuable Gospels that they have in Britain, all written meticulously by hand. So the Liber Ex Legi Moisi, I'm sure, is the book of the law, and I think that's one of the book of the Gospel. So wherever he went, Patrick preached. Now the Saxons came in and pushed, took over, and began to, the Christians who were there, persecuted by the heathen, as she says, which can be documented historically, went down to Cornwall and into Wales and up into southwest Scotland. And that's where Patrick's family happened to be. There were Christians there. They went in that area. Then the pressures came, more and more of them. And after Augustine came, 596, for the next 50 years, Christianity was almost exterminated in Britain. In 664, the Council of Whitby, you may have heard of that in old church history, on the west eastern coast of England, up a ways. By the way, they found a seal, a lead seal, which was on the document that was signed there. In the Council of Whitby, the representatives of the Roman Catholic Church met the representatives of the Celtic Church, mainly from Scotland. It pushed up through Northumbria into Scotland. And the Theodore, the fellow that was from Rome, like everyone who fights something he can't understand, was sarcastic, was derogatory, was disdainful, was proud. He says, you few people in the corner of the earth, are you going to argue with Jerusalem and with Rome and with Antioch? That's where all the brains are. That's where all the wealth is. That's where all the real knowledge is. Do you think you know things that we don't know? Are you going to set right all the doctrines of this big, huge church? And he comes there in all his pompous robes and everything else, impresses them, upmanship. And when the leader of the Celtic Christians at that time saw that nobody would take a serious thought of his doctrines, they wouldn't try to refute his arguments, he gathered up his books and his parchments, walked out, went back to Scotland. Almost the same thing happened in Cornwall and Wales. Then they began to push them in Scotland. So from Scotland they went over to Ireland. And Scots and Irish, and the Irish came from Scotland. When they were pushed over there, there were a few there, but there they found a refuge. And there they worshipped. And you can see all over Ireland, if you look, the round towers go back maybe now 1,400 years. And there are all sorts of remains of their churches. Now when you say church, you've got to bear things in mind. Now, the pioneers here in the United States pushed from New England, say, into Ohio. And the head of the family built a house for his family. And you read in the history book, he built his house for his family. What sort of a house did he build? How big was this thing? 2x4. With an attic you crawled up to and slept in. So when you look for these churches, you could get 3 of them into this room. They're tiny little churches made of stone. Tiny little churches. 20 people seating churches. They were alone. They were there in the wilderness. And so they take the plentiful stones and built up a little stone, all drywalled. They're still standing. And there they would worship. There they would study. They started schools. They started writing. The best illuminated books, I think, on this planet came out of Ireland. If you like to look, if you like to go to their museums and look at them. Irish illuminated manuscripts. Well, they found in Ireland a small population that had some laws of their own. And in one of the biographers, Patrick helped those old pagans, they were, to rewrite their laws, make them more humane. As one of the biographers of Patrick said, Patrick helped them to put a thread of poetry in their law. Real Celt. Celts are poets. They're orators. Their language, Welsh today, and in Ireland, they call it gift of the gab. They can talk, they can use language very beautifully. Their bards would go out and tell all sorts of stories. Well, this Irish law, this ancient, ancient Irish law called the Sanctus Mór, gives relationships. Now, how did the Christians live? Now, if you read the modern history, these were monasteries. They established monasteries here and there. You know, you can mutilate truth with words. Archaeologists have digged around the cemeteries and the trash places. In the cemeteries, they found skeletons of babies and children and women and girls and men. Monasteries. They were communities. They were communities founded on the cities of refuge. Everything was biblical. They'd live in a little walled community. And then they would have their fields outside in the suburbs. And the Sanctus Mór covers that. They cover that. They talk about the fields of the people and the fields of the Christians. They've got it all arranged, all out there. Another biographer discusses the worship that Patrick had every seventh day. Every seventh day. He got a visitor from a friend of his that came from Belgium once. It wasn't called Belgium then. But they had great sweet communion every seventh day. And you look in the Sanctus Mór, and there's ideas of tithe, there's ideas of Sabbath keeping, the laws that came out of the Liber Ex Lege Moisei about relationships, sexual relationships, and relationships to property. They gave the tithe to the church, as they call this community, the Christians. Hinted at in all sorts of ways. And there was when the heathenism took over here, in Europe and in England, the torch still burned in Ireland. Then she says, in the 500s, they began to come across. They began to feel a missionary urge. And she mentions Columba. Now, Columba established himself in Ireland, in Iona. Iona is north of Glasgow on the extreme western coast of Scotland. It's a little island. Tiny little island. 1 mile long. Not a mile long. A few hundred yards wide. Little hill, maybe up 100 feet on it. No trees that you didn't plant. Just fields where you could keep sheep. And there they built their little stone houses. And the distance to Scotland was just a few hundred yards. No problem at all. But there they were. One of the kings of Scotland was persuaded to give this to Columba. Now, how did Columba get there? Now, this again is a story that they tell. It seems to have some truth. Columba wanted to make a copy of the Psalms. So he borrowed from a friend of his, a copy of the Psalms, and made a copy. And the friend who lent him the copy said to him, "That copy is mine." So they had a row. And so they went to court. And the Irish chief was there, and he listened to the case, and then he made his profound statement. A calf belongs to the cow that bore it. The copies belong to the owner of the original.
Now, that may be the first copyright law you ever heard of. But that's what happened.
And Columba was young. He was in his late teens. And he was mad. And he killed his friend. Now what was he going to do? Well, he repented very fast. And then he decided that he had to do something to compensate. He was going to become a missionary. And so he went over. They had coracles. And a coracle was measured by the number of bull hides used to make this circular little boat with a wattle rim to it, like a deep saucer. And if you've ever gone on the Irish Sea, see, the currents come in from the north, from Iceland, and the currents come in from the south through the English Channel. And they meet in the top part of the Irish Sea. And if you've ever had motion sickness, you will get the father and mother of all motion sicknesses if you try to cross the Irish Sea at almost any time. It's an extremely rough crossing. Well, they went across and they established themselves and they began to push eastward through Scotland, down into the north of England, to a place called Whithorn, their remnants, across to Lindisfarne. On the northeast coast, north of Northumbria, they established a settlement. And the farthest east they went was to Gallin in Switzerland and down to Bobbio in northern Italy. They also went into France, and some of their writings has been found in Würzburg in Germany. They spread right through there. Wherever they went, they preached the gospel. Now, these are the bare facts. And it's amazing what a historian can do with it. In the year 717, Nectan, king of Scotland, expelled the Christians from Iona, 717. Now that statement, King Nectan expelled brethren, fratres, from Iona, trans, across the hills of Hibernicum. 9 words. That's in the writings for the annals. See it right there. Check it. That's what happens. It's like a diary they kept. And it's amazing, the annals of Ireland, the annals of Scotland, how detailed. Year by year by year by year by year. Hundreds of years. Now, if you had those 9 words in Latin, how many chapters of a history could you write? Now, you'd be surprised at the numbers of chapters that have been written. What is the mountain of Scotland? Dozens and dozens of articles. Grampians? Could be. What happened? You don't know. He just expelled them. Did he slaughter them? Well, you can make quite a case out. So when you begin to read the history of this, remember the footnote. And don't let yourself be too carried away. What I'm embedding in your brain is a suspicion. Orange light that goes in your mind whenever you read history or theology that anywhere questions the Bible or the spirit of prophecy. Careful. Anyway, they were gone. In their place, they put other brethren. See, they'd become Catholics in between. 664, they gobbled up the Christians in England. 717, they gobbled up the Christians in Ireland, in Scotland. It wasn't until 900 that they finally gobbled up the Christians, few remaining ones, in Ireland. Now, this is the broad story of the history. Now, look how she said it here. Primitive Christians, untouched by Roman. Saxons came to Britain. Christians were forced to retreat. A century later, Columba came to Iona, kept the Sabbath. Crossed over England, Germany, Switzerland, even Italy.
trace them. Map them. Bobby Orr, Molly and I have gone on this pilgrimage. We went to Galat. Trouble is, when you see how the Celts lived, and then you see in Saint-Gallen, in Switzerland today, the church they have built there, monstrosity, big as a football field, full of carvings and orient idols, images, banners, just big, huge medieval Catholic church. Nothing to do with the Celts. But that was a sight. That's all you can say. Everything else is gone. In Bobbio, by the way, they found, many centuries ago, a piece of writing. Wherever Celts go, they wrote. It's called the Muratorian Fragment. Maybe you've never heard of it. If you study the history of the Bible, this fragment lists the books of the Bible in order, indicating again that the Celts were interested in the Bible. Now she says the Rome fixed her eyes. In the 6th century, her missionaries undertook. The emissaries of Rome browbeat the early Christians. If you will not receive us as brethren, you will have to put us up with enemies. We'll make war. As Bede said, they destroyed them. And so these early Christians in Britain, these Celtic Christians, whose doctrines and way of life were untouched by Romish, what does she say here? Romish apostasy, were gobbled up. For all intents and purposes, by 850, they were gone. Few here surviving. But they have left writings. Now, what about their beliefs? Now, she says here they were untouched by Romish apostasy. How could you check this? That was the question. Now, historians say much about it, but where did they get it from? Wilkinson says about it, and he quotes some historians, but to establish it, you've got to go back to the historians that he quotes and find out what their sources were. And that was the fun. You had to get material written in Old Irish. Well, Old Irish stopped being spoken about 825 or 850. Old Irish, like Old English, and Middle English, and English today. So Old Irish. What could you get in Old Irish? Now, this is how evidence is preserved, and it's always thrilled me in this kind of study. God has got techniques. He wants to establish it. He leaves his footprints, Gentry says. He leaves his evidences wherever he wants to go. 100 years ago, it suddenly became fashionable to study Old Irish. Nationalism. See, after the war, Norway decided they were going to talk Norwegian. We're not going to have these solecisms that come in from Germany and Sweden and English, these barbaric countries. We're going to talk pure Norwegian. We're going to teach it in school. Where did they get pure Norwegian from? Iceland. Nobody had touched them. So that's where they studied it. They have revamped their Norwegian. Much to the sorrow of the Ellen White publications, who had all Ellen White translated into Norwegian 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But after the war, they were going to have, so it had to be retranslated. So this vogue in learning Old Irish required readers. And then students of this area began to gather together all the material that they could find in Old Irish and translate it into English. So you get the meaning and read it. So you get it in Old Irish, you get it in English. And they found in Würzburg, in Germany, a commentary in Latin on a commentary written by Pelagius. Now, if you've got any church history in your mind, Pelagius was the bête noire of Augustine of Hippo. 300 plus. Pelagius was a Welshman. Pelagius is his Latinized name. He was a Welshman. He was a Celt. And he came up in North Africa and he preached the Old Gospel. And the Old Gospel that he preached contained the Sabbath. So he was a Judaizer by that time. So
So whenever you read in old church history that somebody is accused of being a Judaizer, he's keeping the Sabbath. Sure sign. And then when you keep the Sabbath, you know what you are? You're a legalist. That's the next slur. You're a Sunday keeper, but you're not a legalist. But you're a Sabbath keeper and you're suddenly a legalist. So Pelagius was a legalist. And so the whole argument of Augustine against Pelagius is Pelagius's legalism. Which is like talking to Adventists about legalism. Legalism. Let's be honest and use these terms correctly. Well, Pelagius had written a commentary on Romans and parts of Hebrew, parts of the Gospel, parts of the Psalms, all in manuscript, in Latin. He'd mentioned the various books, then he had his little commentary. Now, this became interesting to the studies of Old Irish, because in between the lines and all around the margins, each page were a total of over 11,000 comments in Old Irish. So it means that some teacher had been teaching in Würzburg and he had made his own Irish commentaries on the Latin commentary to the Bible that Pelagius had written. And when I saw that, I said, hallelujah. And some fellow had even translated that for me. The Old Irish, not the Latin. That was not no problem. But the Old Irish was the problem. So you can get a whole book of the Old Irish glosses as readers. Not for theology, but as readers for reading Old Irish. So I went through these comments, looked at the verse in the Bible, and then looked at Pelagius' commentary, and then looked at the note of the Old Irish one, and got a picture of what he believed about that. Then all I had to do was to get 3 by 5 cards, and type out the 11,000 bits on it, and put them in piles for different doctrines. What does he say about angels? What does he say about baptism? What does he say about this? And what does he say about the other? And the new covenant, the second coming of Christ, all sorts of things. What does he say about God? What does he say about the Holy Spirit? All these comments. This was a gold mine. Gold mine. Just needed organization. And I was also looking for bits and pieces on the Sabbath. What does he say about the Sabbath? Of course, if the book doesn't quote the Sabbath, there wouldn't be any comment. But I was looking for the Sabbath, established baptism. Now, some of them believed in trine baptism. You know what trine baptism is? In the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, in the name of the Spirit. 3 times. I don't have too much fight with trine baptism. Do it right. But one baptism I would also accept. As baptizing an old ex-marine in the Russian River, north of Cloverdale, many moons ago. If you ever go up north to the big red trees, redwood trees, you have to go over that bridge on 101. Way down below, 7,500 feet, the Russian River goes around the corner. There's a little sandbar. And in there, we were baptizing. We didn't have a baptistry. So I took this. He was the last one. We had about a dozen. He was the last one being baptized. You couldn't see where you were going. He took a stick and stuck it in, made sure you were on terra firma, put the stick there so you knew where you were. You didn't want to go into a chuck hole. Well, I baptized this old gentleman, dear old fellow he was. And as I was getting up, my foot slipped on a slick stone. Down he went again. So I grabbed him and picked him up, and as we were walking 25 feet to the shore, he said, Pastor, wasn't the first time enough? Now, they believed in trine immersion. We believe in one baptism. Well, you can have one baptism, but you can do it 3 times. I don't have any conflict with that. So in the early church that evidently got to Ireland, in some areas, they believed in trine immersion. They also believed in communion of both kinds. Unlike Rome, who believes in only communion of one kind, but that's got a long history. They believed in communion of two kinds. They believed in baptism by immersion. They practiced foot washing before the communion. Foot washing. When I was reading Adam Nan's Life of Columba, no, it wasn't Adam Nan's, it was another one, his Life of Columba, suddenly I saw a line there that made me leap up. It was written in Latin. Columba was a vegetarian for health's sake. Oh, good. So at least he was a vegetarian. Some of the others ate fish.
But at least Columba was a vegetarian. And he was the head man of Iona. Now, almost the same time as Columba was there, little before, another Irishman by the name of Columbanus, his name was Columba too, but to distinguish them, historians call one Columba, whose headquarters was in Iona, and the other one was Columbanus, who headquartered near Lyon in France. That's where his missionary headquarters were located. And he has written some interesting things. He was also a keeper of the Sabbath. He discusses it. And he roused the hostility of the Bishop of Rome, whose name was Leo. And Leo's correspondence with Columbanus and Columbanus' correspondence with Leo are still preserved. You can read them. They're not long letters. But you can read the vituperation with which Leo addressed him and wound up by calling him a dog. This is Columbanus. So Columbanus writes a nice little note back to Leo in Latin saying, the Bible says that a living dog is better than a dead lion. And of course, lion in Latin is Leo. A living dog is better than a dead Leo. That's all the letter he wrote. And I can see the Irishman in Columbanus. He didn't have too much truck with that kind of talk. So the observance of the Sabbath was one of the points that she made. And one of the points of this master's thesis was to prove that there was no evidence for Sabbath observance. Well, in the course of my digging, I found 17 pieces of evidence for Sabbath observance. So just as Ellen White says, the knowledge of the true Sabbath, how does she put it? And thus, the truth was introduced among the people. Among the evangelists was an observer of the Bible Sabbath, and thus this truth was introduced to among the people. So they observed the Sabbath. And as it's been said many, many times, when Columba was dying, he says, this day is the Sabbath, and this is going to be my rest. And he died on it. That was the end. He observed the Sabbath. Now, from the Liber Ex Lege Moisi, they separated between clean and unclean meats. Some of those laws are there. So whether they were all vegetarians or not is difficult to say, but at least Columba, who was their leader, was a vegetarian, which meant that idea was among them. The second coming of Christ was very often repeated in their writings, starting with Patrick. Patrick was a great Adventist. He looked forward to the coming of Christ. If you analyze, as it had been done, this little book, Confessions, is more than half full of quotes, Bible quotes. He loved the Bible, full of the quotes. This Würzburg glosses in Old Irish on the Latin commentary of Pelagius, full of Bible. All they're talking about is the Bible. The manuscripts that have been left, many biblical manuscripts. Wherever they went, they took Bible manuscripts, leaving the truth in Europe. I got a call maybe a year and a half ago from somebody in Long Beach. I was still in Glendale then, saying, are you Leslie Harding? Yeah. Are you the author of this book? Yes. Oh, he was quite ecstatic. He had found it in UCLA library. He said, can I talk to you? So I said, you sure can. So he came and we discussed. He was very interested in the law angle of the Celtic Church, because I expatiated upon the Liber Ex Lege Moisi and the influence this had on the old Irish law, the Sencus Mór, and the modification that it had on Scottish living. And then I quoted some references to say that from Ireland, somebody brought the law to the court of Alfred. You know King Alfred? From Alfred, it was moved to the Magna Carta. From the Magna Carta, it became the basis of British law. From British law, it came over here. And he was writing, this was the two centenary of the Constitution. What year was that? A couple of years ago?
That was a year. It was just that year he came. He was going to write an article, which he has since done, on the biblical basis of the Constitution. That was what he was trying to do. And when he read that Beliefs and Practices of the Celtic Church in Britain and saw the connection there, which I had thought was only incidental, he thought, here, this is the Bible, the Liber Ex Lege Moysi, that comes to Alfred, that goes to the Magna Carta, that comes into British law and comes into the United States and becomes the basis of the Constitution. So the Bible is the basis of the Constitution, which was the moral of his article. The Celts lived in little communities. Now, why did they live in little communities? They were surrounded by pagans with no morals and no scruples. So this became a sort of self-defense mechanism. These became cities of refuge. And in the Senkas Mór and the other Celtic writings, they go out of their way to enlarge upon the fact that the Bible is the model for the living in community. Now you talk about a city. How big is a city? Now if you want to define city in English, you have to start a little way before. You begin with a hamlet. What is a hamlet? It has nothing to do with Ham. But what is a hamlet? No, it isn't a village. That's the next thing. It isn't a town either. See, these are very technical terms. A hamlet is a group of people who live together without a church. In English. I mean, you don't look up Webster now. You look at Murray's English Dictionary on Historical Principles. Then, when they got a church, they could call themselves a village. When that village grew large enough to have a little meeting with a mayor, they became a city. No, they became a town. Excuse me. I'm getting too fast ahead. You have a hamlet, you have a village, then you have a town. Now, in order to be a city, you had to have a cathedral. You had to have a bishop living in that city. You had to have a minister in a village. You had to have a mayor in a town. You had to have a bishop. Of course, they had mayors of cities too, but you had to have a cathedral. And so cathedral cities were not all that numerous. But I was very much surprised when I came to the United States and we held a meeting in the city of York, Nebraska. You ever been to that? It's the egg capital of North America. We had a wonderful campaign there. They call that thing a city. They're two men and a dog and lots of chickens, metaphorically speaking. But they called it a city. So you call Nebraska City a city too. It got no cathedral in it. So the terms have mushed out and have become practically meaningless. But the way it goes is... So when they talk about cities of refuge, you've got to remember they got no cathedral. They were tiny little village centers, sometimes with a wall around them, either of stakes or of stones and rocks for mutual protection. And then outside, the farmers would go through the gate of the city to tend his fields. Then he would come in at the end of the day, bring whatever flocks and herds they had inside. Sometimes they put those flocks and herds in the ground floor and they lived over them. That helped in the central heating. And that was the little community. Small communities. 10, 15, 20 families. Then they sometimes built, as dangers began to come, they built towers, high towers. Maybe 10 feet in diameter, 12 feet in diameter, high up so they can go on the lookout. And sometimes they have ladders up and decks, thick stone walls to these towers that you couldn't get at, so the people population would get up into this tower for a protection. Now, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous runneth into it and is set on high. That's the literal Hebrew. It's translated in King James Version, is safe. And so this idea of high towers came right there. The living in little refuges came out of the Bible. Having the fields of the suburbs came right out of the Bible. And one of the thrusts of my whole work was that the early Christians lived by the Bible. They tried to carry out everything they possibly could by the Bible. Now, during the years they were there, tremendous changes had taken place around the Mediterranean. Tremendous changes. The events in Palestine had a very strong effect on the Christian church. The first big event after Christ's ascension was the destruction of Jerusalem. I don't know whether you have read much on the destruction of Jerusalem. Easiest way to get it is the first chapter in Great Controversy. If you want to read Josephus, go into Josephus and read it. Very vivid, first-hand, eyewitness account. And the Romans besieged, starvation took place, there were many fugitives running out of Jerusalem, giving themselves up to the Romans, who were totally ruthless. They cut down all the trees and they crucified all around Jerusalem every Jew they possibly could get. You looked over the wall and that's the fate, you may as well give up. And finally, in AD 70, they breached the wall, came in, the zealous Jews retreated and retreated and retreated till they got into the temple. Titus wanted to save the temple. It was one of the most beautiful buildings on this planet. And his soldiers were so mad at these people who wouldn't give up, were throwing things at him. One fellow went in there with a torch and he says, "We're going to burn these rats out." And they reduced it to destroyed Jerusalem. Well, the fall of Jerusalem didn't make the Jews popular in the eyes of the Romans. The feeling of the Roman government was getting harder and harder on them. And about 60 years later, Bar Kokhba revolted. By the way, they found autographs of letters he wrote. Interesting, his own handwriting. And the Romans came and attacked him and ate him up. Masada. And then the Roman government was so mad that they declared Judaism illegal. And they banished every Jew outside a 200-mile circle of Jerusalem. Now, if you take your map and get 200 miles of a circle, you're a long way up in the north in Turkey and way down in Egypt in the middle of Saudi Arabia. They cleaned them out. Now, what happened to the Christians who were believing in the Sabbath? You're a Jew. You keep Saturday. No, I'm not a Jew. Yes, you are. You keep Saturday. And you can read in Socrates, the historian, not the Greek, the African, we observe the Sabbath not because we are Jews, but because we worship the Lord of the Sabbath. So that kind of writing in history became necessary for the accusations that were made by everyone else that because you kept the Sabbath, you were a Jew. All right, now what do you do under that kind of pressure? Well, you start keeping it privately. And once you do that, in a little while, you're not keeping it at all. But you want to worship. And so you think to yourself, well, we'll meet on Sunday. We'll meet at another time. We'll meet on Wednesday. We'll meet someplace else. And pretty soon, you're way out. Now, the most popular planetary worship day was Sunday. In our calendar, it doesn't come from Rome quite, it comes from the Saxons. Sunday is the sun's day. Moon day is the moon's day. Tuesday is Dewey's day. Wednesday is Woden's day. Thursday is Thor's day. Friday is Frigus's day. And Saturday is Saturn's day. So they've got the signs of the zodiac or whatever they choose to ascribe to the names of the days of the week. Well, by the time you get up to 300, there were quite a few Christians who said, we are going to keep Sunday. Now, as soon as you start doing that, you've got to look for reasons. You've got to find reasons. Now, in my short life, I have had to deal with many exes, ex-Adventists, and many offshoots. And these exes and offshoots have got to rationalize why they are exiting. And the reason they give you is never the true reason. I don't tell them that, but I just sit and let them talk and wait, and finally they tell me. I don't believe in the sanctity doctrine anymore. And I say to myself, phooey, let me listen. Let me listen. It may take two or three visits if they want to make the visits, but I'm curious. And finally they tell me I had a falling out with so-and-so. That's why they left. I have never met a bona fide exit on theology. There may be some. I'm not saying there aren't. I'm only saying what I have encountered. So when the Christians started to keep Sunday, they had to get a reason. Anti-Jewish pressure was the first thing that made them squeal. And then they had to find a reason. Sunday was the day most people visited the temple. Let's fit in there. We go there. Nobody says anything. By going there. Then they began to say, well, now let's keep it in honor of the resurrection. He's the son of righteousness. That was the dawning of the true son. And so they began to rationalize. Now another interesting point was Christ was crucified on the 14th of Nisan. The 14th of Nisan wanders through the week. It's a full moon. The moon of Nisan, new moon, always starts the month. So the Passover always fell on the 14th of Nisan or Abib. That's when the Jews kept the Passover. They hadn't given it up. As they wandered in their diaspora, they still kept. The Christians, some of them, were honoring God. They wanted to remember the anniversary of Christ's death. You're Jews. No, we're not. Why did you have a meeting yesterday? Yesterday is the Passover. Anti-Semitic pressure. For 200 years, the Christians around the Mediterranean, and now as the years went by, they headquartered in Jerusalem, in Antioch, in Rome, in Constantinople, Byzantium. Those were the four foci of Christian organization. And they'd meet together occasionally in different places. Read of councils here and councils there and councils some other place. And you've heard of the council that Constantine called, 326 AD. You've heard of the council that was called at Laodicea, Hierapolis, Western Anatolia, in 364. For Sabbath keepers, those two are very important councils. Well, they'd meet together in all those years of Semitic pressure, long after Constantine, long after, to decide on the Easter. So if you go into any church history library, you'll find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books and thousands of articles on the Easter controversy. What are we going to do? And then a genius came up in Alexandria, in Egypt, with a suggestion. So that Easter, Good Friday, Easter Sunday, would never fall on the Jewish Passover. And that's the formula by which they calculate Easter today. When does Easter weekend come today? Correct. Right to the button. The first Sunday, following the first full moon that follows the vernal equinox. Since it follows the first full moon, it never lands on a Passover. And so Easter can wander through a month. You can get an Easter late in August, and you can get an Easter in April. They move. Now, they weren't so worried about Christmas Day, so when they finally came to keep it, hundreds and hundreds of years later after they'd settled on the... See, Christmas didn't come in till about 1,000, long time in. They didn't have to fuss with trying to... So they let it wander through the week. So Christ was born on a different day each year, but he died on exactly the same. He died on a Friday. Had to die on a Friday, which makes it totally absurd. Now, all this controversy was unknown to the Celts. Unknown to the Celts. And so when they came and tried to impose their views on them, the Celts demurred. And in Latin, the one who keeps Good Friday or thinks of Christ's death on Good Friday is a quarto deci man. Quarto is four. The deci part of it is 10. That's 14. So if you wanted to translate quarto deci mans, it would be 14ers. So there were some 14ers, and there's some now. There's some Christian communities, not Catholic, that keep Easter at a different time from the Catholics. Crown Orthodox and other churches. And the old Irish, when they were told that they had to keep Easter on the day that Rome promulgated, they didn't like that. And they argued and they argued and they argued. Another thing that Rome had by that time decided to do is that their ministers, their preachers, their priests. Now, this is very difficult for us today to extrapolate back. As soon as you see a priest, you think he's celibate. But you've got to study the origin of celibacy. See, the original Catholic priests were married. There are Catholic communions today in Poland and other places that have married priests. They don't talk about it too much. They try to tell you that you go back to celibacy to Peter and Paul. When you decide something, you've got to find a reason for it. So I would suggest you read A History of the Origin of Celibacy, many books. Auricular Confession. When do you start confessing to a man? The History of Auricular Confession. When do you start, what's the history of transubstantiation? I remember one time with Mary Walsh, her good friends. She's brought many ex-Catholics into the truth. Call her Saint Mary. And I believe she will be a saint. She is a saint. Old lady now. Wonderful friend of ours. We were together trying to study with a young man who'd wanted to become a priest. Nice fellow. In his 40s. He used to go to Mass every day. But he came to the meetings with a friend. And he was impressed. And he studied. And Mary and I discussed the kind of strategy we were going to use. He was seeing the similarities, but he needed to see the dissimilarities to take a stand. So we thought we would discuss the Mass with him. And Mary's got all the literature, so she had an old Catholic dictionary of the doctrines, Catholic Church. So she hands this to the young man in his 40s, told him, look at it. Well, he looked at the beginning, and it had nihil obstat, you know, that nothing obstructs the imprimatur on it. This is kosher. This is Catholic teaching. So she suggested that he turn to a page and read. When did the first idea of transubstantiation come into a human cranium? This dictionary, this historical dictionary, named the man. Named him. 870 something or other. When did it become a doctrine of the actual presence of the body and blood? He's reading down there. Everything is absolute silence. 200 years later, toward the end of the 1100s. And he looks at her. He looks at me. Now what about this starting in the upper room? Now what about this apostolic basis? He told me afterward he couldn't pray for a month. He didn't know what to do. He was nearly sick to his stomach. All the truth that he had faithfully believed had suddenly collapsed. This was a modern thing. 600 years, 700 years old. And of course, it's very easy if you study historical theology, which is my favorite. They say, oh, Adventism is all new. That's so. Where did the first person about the Advent come? You talk to somebody who believes in sprinkling. Oh, we don't. When did sprinkling start? When did sprinkling start? We used to work in Great Britain, and you know they have a prayer book. We got a little red prayer book, it was Molly's, that I take with me when I dealt with an Episcopalian. And the prayer book is right, sure. I said, would you please read the service for the baptism of those of riper years? Oh, I start sometimes with a baby. Start with the baptism for an infant. There's a rubric that goes like this. The priest says to the parents, name this child. And then the rubric in italic says, and naming it after them, he shall dip it in water discreetly and warily. That's the prayer book. And every time I baptize, I used to baptize, I think discreetly and warily. That's how I've got to baptize him. Beautiful. And so the fonts were large as that, and the minister stood outside, and he baptized the infant. And the prayer book was written by Cranmer. The prayer book, 1550 and after, all the emendations. All right? So she reads it. And the first time you read it to somebody, oh, prayer book says baptism by immersion. Then you look at the baptism of those of riper years. He shall dip him in water, discreetly and warily. So I look at them, and it's quiet like this, you know, they're dead silent. Then you can look at the end of the service. But if they shall signify that the child be not able to bear it, it shall suffice to pour water on the head of the child. So I asked them, have you ever seen a minister pour water on the head of a baby? No, never. You know, some of those Church of England old churches are cold. You know what that baby would do if you suddenly poured ice-cold water on its head? The decorum of that church service would be shattered in a few seconds. What would it do to that beautiful lace christening robe that has been handed down from great-great-great-great-grandma? What it doesn't say in the prayer book is if they decide that the pouring is too much of a nuisance, it shall suffice to dip the finger in water and make a sign of the cross on the somnolent brow of the infant. All right, then you say, which is baptism? Is it by dipping? Is it by pouring? Is it by making a mark of the cross? And you can do the same thing to the Catholics if you get the history. So you can get the history of the Sabbath, you can get the history of baptism, you can get the history of communion, history of foot washing, many books on the history of foot washing. When was it finished? There was a council in Spain, 15 or so, that decreed that foot washing was no longer to be carried out. 1,500 years. Pope still carries it out. Kings and queens of England used to carry it out till quite recently. On Maundy Thursday. Maundy is the Latin word for wash up. It's the wash up Thursday when you wash your feet. It's before Good Friday. And kings and queens would get 12 ex-soldiers, retired army soldiers. They would be sit on a platform, they'd wash their feet, and then they'd give them a special coin called a Maundy penny, indicating that foot washing was there. Now you can trace this back to the Celtic Church. They had no transubstantiation. They had communion of both kinds. They preceded it with foot washing. They had no auricular confession. They confessed direct to God. They believed in the Bible. They believed in baptism. They believed in the second coming of Christ. They believed in health reform. I found indications that they believed in the state of the dead that we believed right down the line. So when you read in Ellen White that this group of Christians was untouched by Roman apostasy, they were there. Their evidences are still there. Molly and I traveled here and there, trying to catch a glimpse of the remnants of these faithful Christians, finally annihilated. Their books, some museums, their little churches and high towers, comments of one of their teachers in thousands of glosses, simplicity, sincerity, biblical-based trust in God. That's our heritage. That's what we are supposed to do. So when you read this two pages again, 62 and 63, when I finished my book and had it published, I looked back and said, only inspiration could write so accurately. We got a treasure here. We got a greater treasure here. We got a treasure over there.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.